Westcliff in 2015.
Good afternoon. Today is March 21st, 2017. Welcome to spring, everybody. By the way, dependent on who you talk to, it either started yesterday or started today. I'll take it either way. We're opening a public hearing. First of all, opening the subcommittee on public safety, and we will open a public hearing on House Bill 5004, Department of Corrections. We have a number of people that are debating. Oh, what do we have?
Debating. No, but we're starting where we left off.
Oh, yes. So we have a number of people who have been debating who gets to sit where this morning or this afternoon. We'll see how they land, but we will invite up. Actually, let's pick up where we left off yesterday. We didn't quite make it to slide number 59, which is, I know, where you wanted to finish off. And so remember to introduce yourself and take it away.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair and members of the committee. We're happy to return this afternoon. And first, I'd like to apologize. Yesterday, we did not have the slide numbers on the slides. We have corrected that. They are there today.
Thank you.
And you're welcome. And we are hoping that we get through offender management and rehabilitation presentation by Assistant Director Heidi Stewart. That means we need to get to slide 92 today. And with that, I will turn it over to Assistant Director Mike Gower to pick up where we left off. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Stock, Co-Chair Winters, members of the committee. My name is Michael Gower. I'm the Assistant Director for Operations. Part two, we're picking off, starting where we stopped.
We want you to start over and say good afternoon and Co-Chair Stock.
I want you to know how happy I am to have that taste of home.
There's only 25 letters in my alphabet. No offense, Co-Chair. In 1994, Oregon voters enacted Ballot Measure 17, which requires our adults to work full-time or engage in programs. Inmate work programs are about keeping our adults engaged as much as it about security management is preparing for reentry. Here you see some great illustrations, some pitches. To the left, we have some of our adults inspecting onions and doing some potatoes out at Snake River up in the top-hand right corner. They're painting over at Malheur County Fairgrounds. In the middle, we have some South Fork adults that are learning safety with chainsaws, and then we have some seedlings from Snake River, sagebrush seedlings that are getting ready to be planted. In the 2016 fire season, we, DOC, assisted with 36 separate fires. We had about 400 adults participate in a total of 3,603 days of adult in custody work days. Several of our adults that learned this trait with firefighting in our custody are able to go out into the real world and pick up these jobs once they leave. Another exciting news in our work programs, May 17th of this year, the Pendleton City Council voted unanimously to end a nearly 30-year ban of not allowing any of our adults in custody to be working in that community. So they lifted that ban for us. However, since Pendleton, or EOCI, our prison there, is a medium custody facility, we are not in the business of letting the inmates come in and out of the work crews. We're sending work crews over from our Two Rivers, Umatilla work site to work in the community. So that's pretty exciting news with the 30-year ban being lifted.
What was the reason for the ban in the first place?
Co-Chair, go ahead.
Mr. Co-Chair and Senator Winters, it was an original agreement when we took that facility over from the state hospital. It was an original agreement with the community that we would not let individuals outside of the fence.
Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have the opposite. Madras had an agreement when Deer Ridge opened up, and then under previous leadership, that agreement was pulled. Did that ever get re-energized? You could check in.
Mr. Co-Chair and Representative Huffman, by re-energized, meaning are we letting folks outside of that facility?
To work with. I think predominantly the lead was the city on it, running point.
So my understanding is that, yes, we are. We have fire crews that are coming out of that facility. I'll turn to Mr. Gower to see, do we have them working inside the community as well?
Co-Chair Stark and Representative Huffman, yes, that is correct. To my knowledge, that this has been ongoing, even though with the transformation from the exiting of the minimum side of the house and bringing our adults over to the medium, we have always been very aggressive in the Deer Ridge area Madras, trying to find some contracts within that community. But we do have some contracts that would do help with the firefighting efforts out in that area.
Thank you. Much appreciated. It really caused a lot of heartburn when the ability to use them after the agreement with the community to start up. So it's nice to know it's going smoothly. Thanks.
Thank you.
The next slide here, we have the KPM number one for Measure 17 compliance. DOC, with the support of Oregon Correctional Enterprises, is continuing to strive to provide an increasing number of meaningful work and training opportunities for our adults. As the director said earlier, we actually experienced two highs for our agency. For DOC work assignments, we got as high as 8,024 inmates that have been able to be employed with DOC. At the same time, OCE was able to get as high as 1,403 inmates. Unfortunately, with DOC and OCE trying to create more meaningful opportunities, we've experienced a population increase, which results in a fairly steady Measure 17 compliance rate. And efforts to increase this percentage, it remains difficult for us because we're very mindful about replacing workers in the Oregon communities.
What, Mr. Chair?
What
percentage of them are where they couldn't work at all? Or do you have a percentage of residents who would not be eligible because of medical conditions or other issues?
Co-Chair Stark and
Does those stats take that in consideration?
Co-Chair Stark and Senator Winters. Yes, the stats do come from the ones that are eligible to work. We do have folks who either have medical incapacitation or some mental health issues, so they get separated out from our measurements. So these are all ones that are able to be qualified to work.
Okay.
In addition to work and programming, the department provides a range of an adult activities. Here you can see on our slide, the upper left, that's actually Two Rivers Men's Choir. Up on the right, we had a walkathon at OSCI. It was for Angel Tree. It's a nonprofit that helps local children here in the community. Powwow to the left down at OSCI for the Native Americans. And, of course, we have everyone's lovable pets there with the dogs. And this is a dog program we have at EOCI. It's the Joys of Living Assistance Dog. It's a nonprofit agency that we work with, Salem-based. That raises and trains dogs for a position of service in the community. Over the past several years, the Operations Division has seen many expansions and enhancements to our programs. I've mentioned a few already, but the next slide I'll just briefly touch a little bit more. Of course, we're always looking for strong connections and partnerships with our state and local organizations. Our longest standing partnership is with the Oregon Department of Forestry and Tillamook Forest. It is a 50-year partnership where we're able to, men out there are able to fight fires, plant trees, maintain trails, parks, as well as campgrounds. We're happy to state to this committee, on the upper left-hand side of this these photos, you'll see that is the first all-female firefighting crew that was deployed this past year. Although they were only able to help with one fire, they were the first ones to arrive there with our ODF partners. They were able to cut fire lines and perform initial firefighting duties. For the rest of the season, they assisted the Department of Forestry with fuel reductions and other efforts.
Mr. Have we done a calculation as to how much the economic value of the residents that are helping with firefighting? This is something that annually we have in the state of Oregon. unfortunately, one wish that we did not, but we do. And in some years, the fires are a lot more vociferous and widespreading than others. So it'll be interesting because of the price tag that's involved, as you know, that also comes out of our general fund dollars, of how much that we're contributing to the cost of the manpower. Do you have that?
Mr. Co-Chair and Senator Winters, we do have that number. I thought I had it at my fingertips, and I don't, so we will get that to you in writing.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's substantial. It's a number we're very proud of.
And as we speak of partnerships, Powder River over in Baker City has formed a new partnership this biennium with the Union Soil and Water Conservation District to provide some adult work crews to assist with planting trees in the Catherine Creek area in Union County to aim at protecting the fish habitat. Other cost savings examples here pictured on the left and the right, you'll see that we're performing our own duties on resurfacing one of our basketball courts out at inmate basketball courts at Baker City at a considerable savings opposed to going out to the community. On the left-hand side, we're making our own utility shed. And on the right side, that's Pendleton, that's our EOCI facility. They've replaced irrigation landscaping with dry landscaping and transformed this area to a vegetable garden space, reducing water usage this past summer to over 20%. And of course, in the middle there, you'll see one of our physical plant workers from Two Rivers that has parked his gas-powered John Deere vehicle in lieu of riding his Wizard of Oz bike around to show that Two Rivers is going green initiative. In December of 2015, our intermediate care unit, we call it ICH, I-C-H, at OSP, moved from our Delta unit in the special housing unit, what used to be the old IMU building at OSP, over to E Block. The ICH unit houses inmates that have serious mentally ill that due to their acuity. They can't live in treatment units or in general housing. By moving this unit over to the E Block over at OSP, the inmates are now allowed to access general population yard and have a new open living inviting area for programming with natural light, as you can see on the bottom left. On the right-hand side, we're very proud. This is a dedication to the five branches of our military that the adults in custody over there have raised money to actually resurrect a flagpole with five of plaques representing the five military branches. Over at Snake River, we have a unit, 72 beds, that consists of all men that have served at one point or another in our military, all living together. Here are some great examples of our gardening. DOC has developed gardening programs at all our institutions. DOC yielded 235,000 pounds of produce in 2016. About 14,000 were donated to local food banks throughout our county outreach programs throughout the state. And this past year, too, we've also developed a partnership with a gentleman from Westport, Connecticut, who is giving us seeds, $350 worth of seeds to each institution that wanted to be part of this program. We're going to have four institutions, and he told me now this will get him up to 106 prisons across the nation that he is supplying this service to. So it's pretty exciting. And the one thing he asked, we have to not only supplement some of our vegetables for our adult population, but we have to give a percentage to the local food banks. Our enhanced visiting and family, this is something that I'm very proud of. In the last 14 years since I've been here, extremely proud of the efforts from all our institutions. When I came here, I think the women at Coffee Creek were getting a lot more attention with their children. And now I can proudly say, by the efforts of our superintendents and all the staff, we are doing a fantastic job trying to integrate our families, not only with the women, but with all the men. And here are some great opportunities, and you can just see the smiles on the faces of the adults in custody as well as the kids. Upper right-hand corner, we have a a Halloween festivity at Mill Creek, top left. Baker City had a family day. On the bottom left was a kids' camp out at Snake River. And on the bottom right, this is an outside play area that was recently constructed at OSP's Visiting Center. And we're proud of this because the money was raised from our adults in custody. There was some support from the outside resources. And I want to make sure that I give a shout-out to Hal's Construction that donated time and materials to help construct this project. My last slide here for customer service under KPM. In the past, we used our parole and probation brothers and sisters as our customer. We, however, have changed that focus to what we just described to you as one of our biggest initiatives, and that is enhancing our visiting. Here, unfortunately, we didn't make our KPM targets. On our first attempt to reach this customer base with the people coming in to visit our adults in custody, only 316 people completed this survey. And as you can see, it didn't meet our expectations. So we're going to turn around in the next year or two and make sure that we try to enhance these numbers, providing location-specific survey results, identifying areas of improvement, and like I said, trying to get this survey done within the next year or two. But here is some put things in perspective.
41, Rep. Barker.
Thank you. So I just was wondering if you know, like, percentages of people who have visitors. Are there a large number who don't have visitors? Or I don't know if you keep those statistics.
Co-Chair Stock and Representative Barker, yes. In the time period that we've really turned on this initiative to show the importance, and we know from the Minnesota study how important visiting is, a few years ago, 60% of our inmate population didn't have any visits at all, and we have now flipped that. We're now 60%, if I'm not mistaken, Director.
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Winters, we flipped it and improved it beyond that. It's well over 70% now who are receiving some form of visiting, so we've really flipped that number on its head.
And does that include your telephone visits then?
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
And to put this in a little bit of perspective, we had a little over 32,000 individual visitors over the age of 18.
Senator Steiner Hayward.
So sorry to interrupt you again. Ms. Peters, you and I have talked about the telephone and the video visits in the past and the cost associated with those. Are you going to be covering that at all, Mr. Gower? Or, don't have much disposable income, so.
Mr. Co-Chair and Senator Winters, I can cover that really quickly.
Okay.
So in our new phone system, it's a few years old now, but still new to us in terms of the great technology we've inherited. It implemented a consistent cost per minute. It was inconsistent in the previous contract, and it's 16 cents per minute.
Oh, that's not bad.
For everyone. And then the video visitation, which I really like to stress that was not to take away from in-person visiting. It really was to supplement visiting. And you can visit with your family member, essentially Skyping with them for 30 minutes for $10.
Much more affordable. Thank you.
I want to follow up on that. So, and I believe the phone contract's coming up for bid this year again. Is that right?
Mr. Co-Chair and Representative Barker, it was up for review. There is a backlog at DAS in contracts, and so we've actually extended the contract just yesterday, I believe, for another 3 years. We don't know that it will take that long to get an RFP out, but we extended the contract to ensure that we'd be able to get the new RFP out in that time period.
Okay. I spoke with somebody who wanted to who wanted to bid on that, claimed they would was quite a bit cheaper and so on, so.
Mr. Is there any reason why you put it out for 3 years rather than, you know, I know DAS has a backlog. That's the reason for the extension, but why 3 years?
Mr. Co-Chair and Senator Winters, that was a recommendation for DAS. They wanted to be sure that they only extended it once, and they were confident that they would be able to get the RFP out and wrapped up within that three-year period.
Are they overworked, or what's the deal?
Long time.
Mr. Co-Chair,
that seems like an awfully long time to talk about having somebody to actually bid out and get the specs and all that for a contract.
Mr. Co-Chair and Senator Winters, I won't want to speak for DAS, but I do understand it's a workload issue.
Just to put it in perspective, we had 32,000 individual visitors over the age of 18, and a total amount of visitors was 292,000 visitors at all our institutions over the past year. That concludes my part of the presentation. I just want to say thank you for allowing me to present. If there's any questions pertaining to the operations division, Mr. Joe Defoe will be coming behind me to talk about the health services portion. Thank you very much.
Mr. Co-Chair and members of the committee, I would like to introduce Joe Defoe, who is our Health Services Administrator and who's here to talk about his section of the organization.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Stark, Co-Chairs Winters, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Joe Defoe. I'm the Health Service Administrator for the Oregon Department of Corrections. It's a pleasure to be here to represent the Health Services team. I'll provide a general overview of the Health Services operations and then identify some main budget drivers and some of the primary challenges for us in delivering correctional health care, to include recruiting, housing, aging population, electronic health records, and the cost of pharmaceuticals. At the end, I'll speak to some of the successes and process improvements that we have made in order to continue delivering the health care that our population we serve deserve. This slide demonstrates the health services budget, which is 15% of the general fund for both all funds and general fund perspectives. In this slide, we're looking at the health services full-time employees in comparison with the rest of the agency. These 575 full-time employees include physicians, physician assistants, nurse practitioners, registered nurses, dentists, dental assistants, psychiatrists, qualified mental health professionals, pharmacists, medication technicians, administrative and office staff support. One of the major budget drivers are off-site care, recruitment and retention, cost of medications, an increase of number of medically complex, chronically ill, fragile, and elderly adults in custody. Two of them I'll focus more on, which is the off-site care and the cost of medications. The Department of Corrections Health Services section provides legally mandated medical, dental, mental health, and pharmacy service to approximately 14,600 adults in custody located in 14 institutions across the state. Off-site medical care, which is one of our key performance measures, recruitment, retention, cost of medications, and the challenges presented by an increasingly sick and complex patient base all impact our budget directly. As I move through my presentation, I'll discuss each of these budget drivers in more detail, with a focus on the two that I discussed earlier, off-site medical care and the cost of pharmaceuticals. Health Services has 14 clinics, one in every institution. Levels of care and coverage vary. We operate infirmary-level care in 5 of our larger institutions. Our team is faced with medical problems similar to that exist in outside community, ranging from minor to major health issues, acute illnesses or injuries, to ongoing care for chronic disease, preventative health care, and end-of-life care or hospice. For the 2015 calendar year, we had over 1 million medical encounters. That's an average of 90,000 per month. The vast majority, over 99% of these encounters, were treated within the walls of the institution. To accomplish this task effectively and efficiently, the department used the managed care model, which includes on-site primary care with early intervention and prevention, specialty care through contracted providers, off-site care with specialists as needed, access community hospitals when necessary, and we have in-house dental.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Steiner Hayward.
I know you're going to get into more detail. I'm just going to put up front. Can we set up a separate time to talk about this? Because I've got a whole boatload of questions, and I don't want to take up a lot of the committee's time. Thank you.
Alrighty.
Thanks. This is one of the places where the healthcare stuff and the public safety stuff intersect, and I'm very curious about, for example, do you use the same prioritized list that the CCOs do? How does your I'm
Mr. Co-Chair, like Senator that. Hayward, absolutely.
Thank you very much. I would enjoy that.
Appreciate
that.
You bet. Health Service operates a comprehensive intake screening process with the goal of identifying incoming adults in custody with health issues for the purpose of understanding individual health care needs and to strategically place adults in custody in appropriate institution as we're able to. Medical expenses versus off-site care, and this is one of our key performance measures.
Mr. Chair, just for clarity before, Director Peters, you may want to share with this panel the issue surrounding the differential in care in the institution and what the courts have said with respect to what you need to provide. This has been an issue for years as to whether or not we can actually do what the good senator would like to have done and what the courts have said that must take place inside of an institution. So it may be well that you share the court that opinion with members, because it's been one that we've wrestled with for years.
Certainly, Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Winters, and members of the committee, we are legally required to provide a community standard of care inside of our institution. So we would not ever be able to make a budgetary decision and say medical issues that cost this amount will not be funded inside the Oregon Department of Corrections. We are required to provide that community standard of care, and we look very closely at that as we make our medical decisions. We also, as note, with the task force that actually studied our health services out of 3194, which Senator Winters was a part of, really, really looked at our health services department, asked questions around could we do it less expensively if we privatized, and asked all those sorts of questions. And we actually learned that we are able to provide what the CCOs are wanting to provide, right? We have all of our doctors under one jurisdiction, all of our mental health professionals and our doctors and our dentists are all talking about that individual patient. It really is the CCO model. And I don't have the numbers memorized anymore. I did a couple of years ago, so we can provide them in writing. We actually are able to provide those medical services less expensive than they're being provided in the community. Thank you.
This chart also, medical expenses versus off-site care, this is one of our key performance measures. This chart represents our medical service costs, does not include behavioral health, dental, or pharmacy services. With our off-site costs overlaid using the line graph, it shows that between the years 2007 and 13, medical costs consistently increased, both in overall costs and in off-site costs. After 2014, our off-site expenditures have decreased as a result of utilizing Medicaid for hospitalization claims, which most likely offset any rising overall health care costs. The projected overall medical costs have increased to $137.8 million for the current 15-17 biennium. In 2006, Department of Correction Health Services made a decision to purchase an enhanced service from a third-party administrator, or TPA. Department of Corrections rate of savings has significantly improved, and inappropriate overnight bed days are now denied payment. Since the health service operation is not a revenue center, but rather a large cost center, the work of the TPA is one of the services that are most influential and positively impact our budget. Correctional Health Partners is a third-party administrator. They provide a discounted provided network up to 25% off billed rates, comprehensive case management to reduce hospital bed days, improve clinical outcomes. Every patient gets a daily case management review that's in the hospital. And there's data management and reporting. The Behavioral Health Services. The Behavioral Health Services, or BHS unit, provides services to mentally ill inmates in 8 staffing institutions. The largest numbers of mentally ill inmates are housed at Snake River Correctional Institute in Ontario, and the most severely mentally ill are housed at the Oregon State Penitentiary in Salem and the Coffee Creek Correctional Facility in Wilsonville. The Department of Correction has an increasing number of inmates reach our system without having been treated in the community, to the point where over the past decade, the department has become the largest mental health provider in the state. The BHS team provides a range of evidence-based services based on the best practice, such as comprehensive assessment, psychopharmacology, behavioral health interventions, individual and group therapy, case management, and opportunities to practice new skills in the least restrictive housing environment.
Senator Center Hayward.
I'm going to put you on the spot, Ms. Peters, but I did this to Ms. Stewart when I visited Coffee Creek. Given what you just said about the state being the largest mental health, the correctional system being the largest mental health provider, how many of those incarcerations do you think we could have prevented with adequate mental health treatment? What percentage in the community? System-wide.
Mr. Co-Chair and Senator Hayward, I wouldn't even want to venture a guess. However, I believe strongly that the Affordable Care Act and the philosophy and vision around our CCOs and where we want to go, that it's going to have an incredibly positive impact on public safety. This whole notion that they could receive mental health treatment, alcohol, drug treatment before they committed a crime and created a victim, let alone receiving those resources when they go back into the community so they don't re-victimize again, I can only imagine it would be a very large number.
Thank you.
Another question, Mr. Chair.
Chair Winters.
Can you tease out, and I'm really interested in the trend lines on the pharmaceutical drugs and whether or not, in looking at the increase in cost, how much that has increased in your budget? Just give me the last, I'd say, 4 or 5 years. I don't want to go back to 2006. I want to see what has happened, particularly as we look to see the population go up and some of the special things that we've done. I'd really be interested in seeing what those costs are.
Mr. Co-Chair and Senator Winters, absolutely. That's a few slides down the road, but we will cover that.
And will you also cover the outstate, offsite visits and what those costs are and what those trend lines look like?
Offsite. I believe Co-Chair Stark and Senator Winters, I believe I will address some of that, but if I don't, we can readdress it at that point, if that's okay with you.
Good.
Okay. Thank you. Behavioral health services. There are many ways to break down the types of care provided by our behavioral health services, but in broad terms of care covers continuum of housing based on acuity. Mental Health Infirmary, or the MHI, we have a 59-bed facility, which is the highest level of mental health housing, and that's at our Oregon State Penitentiary and the Coffee Creek Correctional Facility. Intermediate care housing, we have a 70-bed, and that's a step-down unit. It's the second highest level of mental health care. We then have two kinds of general population units for our behavioral health patients. A day treatment unit, which is 108 beds, and that's designed for patients with severe and persistent mental illness and moderate to high acuity. We have a mental health unit, which is a 552-bed, designed for the vulnerable population of patients with mental illness or developmental disabilities. And we have the behavioral housing unit, which is the BHU, 49 beds, and that's designed for patients with serious mental illness and demonstrated violent behavior. Pharmacy and medical stores. The second budget driver that I wanted to really emphasize was the cost of medications. The health service unit operates two pharmacy and medical store packaging and distribution centers in Salem and in Ontario, serving all institutions. We have distributed over 32 million of medications this biennium to date. Our pharmacy operations currently prepare, package, and distribute over 30,000 prescriptions per month for adults in custody. Our pharmacies and institution medication rooms are licensed and regulated by the Oregon Board of Pharmacy and Federal Drug Enforcement Agency. Pharmacists regularly inspect institution medication rooms to ensure compliance with policy and regulations and to provide consultation to site managers. In 2016, both pharmacies received DEA drug manufacturer approval.
Senator Dr. Steiner Hayward.
Really quickly. 33,000 a month is essentially equivalent of two prescriptions for every single person in DOC custody. Now, lots of adults, especially people who have had difficult lives, which many of these folks have to take medications because we know that things like adverse childhood experiences increase your risk for chronic illness down the road. Does that include non-prescription medications like as needed ibuprofen or Tylenol when someone gets a horrible headache, or do we not? I mean, I'm assuming we provide those. Or does that, is those are just straight out 33,000 a month daily prescription?
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Hayward, I believe that is only prescription medications, but I will get that information back to you. It is a lot.
Mr. Co-Chair and Senator Steiner Hayward, that's my understanding too, so we'll verify that. But when you think about it, over 50% of those in our care and custody have a significant mental illness. And if you tease out the women, it's over 70%. And so I think your simple math is very accurate.
Front load.
Thank you.
We do use a restricted medication formulary that is established and monitored by a multidisciplinary professional pharmacy and therapeutics committee known as the P&T. We also participate in the Oregon State contract with the Minnesota Multi-State Contracting Alliance for Pharmacy, also called MCAP, which is a consortium of government entities making pharmaceutical purchases. Our membership provides deep volume discounts on pharmaceuticals and careful management of accounts with the medication wholesalers, ensures that DOC receives the best credit terms. Now I want to provide you some data on some of the pharmaceuticals. General drug costs.
Mr. Chair, do you have the same, you do for pharmaceuticals, what about supplies and durable medical equipment? Do you also have a coordinated effort among other states for that as well and get a discount for those?
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Winters, absolutely. MCAP actually does some of our non-pharmaceuticals supplies, correct. Pharmacy drug costs. The 2011 to 13 biennium, we spent $22.2 million. Those numbers are rounded a little bit. 2013 to 15, $30.7 million. And 2015 to 2017, $31.8 million. Year to date, with a projected $43.8 million.
And my question is, why are we seeing those going up? I mean, that's my total question. And looking over time, what's occurring in the population? Is it mental health? Is it, you know, what really is taking place inside of the institution?
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Winters, I would have to deep dive further into
I want you to deep dive into that number.
Okay. I will be talking about some hepatitis C drugs as well, and psychotropic drugs as well to answer the question, is that a psychiatric drug problem? So,
Rep. Huffman?
Well, thank you. I think you just touched on it, because I was going to say one of the changes over the last few years has been Sovaldi drugs like that for... And so I think you're going to get into that.
I still want to have a deep dive.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, that's quite a, and I understand the Hep C issue that's there, but I think we need to know just really what is beginning, what your environment is, and what some of those cost drivers are.
Okay, the cost of new branded hepatitis C medications are receiving significant attention across the country. As new Hep C products come to market, they are now 100% effective with fewer side effects. Due to the demographics of our patient population, it stands to reason that our system sees a disproportionate number of those with hepatitis C than the community at large. Hepatitis C costs. 2011 to 2013 was $3.6 million actual. That's 138 patients that were treated. 2013 to 15 was a $4.5 million. That's 152 patients treated. 2015 to 2017, actual to date is $10.2 million, projected $14.5 million, and a projected 283 patients to be treated. Health Services has approximately 46 active patients treated with Harvoni and 22 patients treated on a newer Hep C medication, Epclusa. Although there have been significant savings in the Harvoni cost, there has been a rise in the use of non-discounted medication, Epclusa. And here's the breakdown. So if you have an 8-week Harvoni treatment, Harvoni could be 8 or 12 weeks. If you have 8-week treatment, our cost without our rebate is $63,000 for a treatment, 8-week treatment. With our MCAP discounts, it's $32,000. A 12-week treatment for Harvoni is $94,000 without a rebate, $48,000 with our rebate. Epclusa is a 12-week only treatment. $74,000 without a rebate, $74,000 with a rebate. So there's no rebate. Harvoni treats, and here's the rationale of why this new drug is coming on the market and we're using it. Harvoni treats hepatitis C genome types 1 or 4 and limited 3. Epclusa treats hep C genotypes 1 through 6. So those with the genotype 3 that is ineffective through Harvoni will receive Epclusa. So we're starting to see more patients with that require the Epclusa, and we're not getting a discount on those drugs. So the cost is rising.
If we did a comparison with other states our size and our institution, how would we compare with them on the cost of drugs?
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Winters.
Aren't most of the institutions also are using some of these products that we talk about, Hep C?
I believe nationwide they are. I think that the two questions, one would be what is their hepatitis rate, and then two, mm-hmm. what is their drug usage costs. Right. That's an analysis that we can do, and we will get that to you.
Thank you.
If to make sure the literature is out there, which I'm assuming it is, but we will definitely deep dive in that.
I would think that we're not the only one that's asking the question on the whole issue of pharmaceuticals and how we can be able to start beginning to controlling some costs, just as it occurred when we started the multi-purchasing of bulk purchasing. So I'm really rather interested in how we're going to bend this cost curve.
Psychotropic drugs. In 2014, July 2014 to 2016, 2,258 adults in custody were treated with psychotropic drugs. The cost of $3.7 million. The cost of psychotropic drugs can change considerably in 1 year. Speaking with our chief pharmacist, the opinion is that although these drugs are high in use, there is not a feeling that they're increasing in use. Our pharmacy team will continue to work with our MCAP to receive discounted medications, continue to monitor the reasons and cost of emergency use of community pharmacies, monitor request and control of non-formulary medications, treatments by providers, control the use of more costly branded medications in a favor of effective generic versions. In the calendar year 2012, 92% of our medications purchased were generic versions.
Mr. Chair, it would be interesting to note, and I'm going to yield to my good senator to my right, which is normally to my left, but she's to my right today. And it would be interesting to note, based on, the whole in mental health and the CCOs, how much are we spending on pharmaceuticals? I'd like to begin to look at this whole issue in Oregon, particularly when we start talking about, some of the mental health drugs and what have you, and what are we paying both inside as well as outside. Mm-hmm. Because the drug tab is being, for Oregon is in both areas. So it may be something for the future to begin looking at, Senator.
Yeah. The more I learn about drug purchasing, Senator, the more confused I get. And I would like to commend the Department of Corrections for the work that they're doing, partnering with other states. That would take 2 whole more hours to have a conversation,
right.
But I agree with you completely. And I think it's one of the conversations I want to continue to have offline.
Great.
And I will add to that, we have a top-notch pharmacy team for Department of Corrections.
I'm sure you do. I'm not questioning your top-notch team. I'm questioning cost.
Correct. I just wanted to add that. And reduce loss by recovering and repackaging medications where practical. This is to show the chart inside of the volume of medications being prescribed over the system. For example, in 2013-15, you can see we filled 887,000 prescriptions. 296,000 were new, 36% increase. A 591,000 refills, a 6% increase from 2011 to 13. It is precisely because of this volume that we are so diligent in managing our purchase agreements and distribution network. We do face some challenges in a number of areas. Recruitment, retention, and this is a budget driver. We continue to struggle recruiting medical professionals, especially physicians and mid-level providers. Rural areas are difficult, but the challenges remain statewide and even national in the case of nurses and physicians. In 2016, we hired a medical recruiter, a certified medical recruiter, to assist in bringing on needed medical professionals. Due to the majority of private sector healthcare professionals working in an electronic environment, having an EHR will inherently assist us in recruitment, which is an expectation from those that are utilizing an electronic health system in the private sector. We are also currently developing a telehealth program to address the provider shortage in the rural areas. Aging population, and this is also a budget driver. In the community, geriatrics is the discipline of medicine specializing in the care of the aged, defined as 65 years and older. In prison, the age at which adult in custody deemed geriatric varies from state to state. In some states, adults in custody as young as 50 are defined as geriatrics. In other states, they are not considered geriatric until they reach the age of 55 or 60. Despite these differing definitions, there is consensus that those incarcerated undergo a process of accelerated aging compared to their age-matched counterparts outside of prison. Nearly every state is seeing that upward tick in elderly state prisoners. Healthcare for aging prisoners costs far more than it does for younger ones, just as it does on the outside of the prison walls. Correction departments across the country report that healthcare for older prisoners costs between 4 and 8 times what it does for the younger prisoners. Age 60 and older, a current snapshot of our population of 60 and older. 917 males, 39 females. Of those, 436 have mental health needs, and 412 have substance abuse. Typical top diagnosis for this group is cardiovascular, respiratory, vascular such as aneurysms and stroke, and cancer. And for those that have a psych diagnosis, depression, PTSD, anxiety, and schizophrenia are the top diagnosis.
Question, Mr. Chair. Since you do not have electronic records, and just know that I used to be a record librarian, do you manually do your charting? Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, we do.
So how difficult will it be for me to get a medical profile of your advanced 114 individuals who are over the age of 75?
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Winters, it's a manual process, so it's the difficulty, probably not that difficult, but time-consuming. But it's doable.
I'm putting in my request.
Okay.
Noted.
Yeah. I might regret that one. No, I won't regret it. I'll do it, personally. Having an EHR... Okay, with the second analysis program, which is extremely important, it's not just the EHR. You have to have a program connected to it to be able to extract the data out of the EHR. We'll get us this information in the future. However, in the meantime, we'll be looking at ways to manually mine the data so we can start to understand the impact of incarceration environment is having on their well-being, their ability to maintain health, independency, and the cost associated. According to a 2013 report published by the Federal Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services, or CMS, the cost per American per month for health care in 2013 was $771. Currently, with our adults in custody, between 2013, our actual was $596 a month, and 2015 to 17, currently at $653 a month.
One moment, Representative Barker.
Thank you. So, you have these elderly people in there. How many of them are going to die in prison? How many of them are not going to get out? Do you have any idea? I mean, I know I'm talking about somebody prematurely dying, but just from their sentences, how many does it look like are going to die in the...
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Barker, 93% will return to our communities, so 7% will...
Of the elderly?
Well, 7% of our overall population will die in prison.
Okay, so what I want to know is, like, of the elderly people, what I'm kind of cutting the chase on that is the good senator and I visited Angola, as we've talked about before. So they had quite an extensive hospice program down there of people who were not going to ever get out. And so they trained them, and then these people are doing, everybody down there, I mean, their financial thing is so bad down there, everything is prisoner run. I mean, they did have some nurses and doctors, but their instructors, everybody's prisoners. But they had a very extensive and I thought looked like well-run hospice program where they trained up people who then also are going to probably not get out. Angola, a huge number of people do not get out. And anyway, I just wonder if you have something like that lined up where you would train people. So I get trained to be hospice because I know I'm going to need hospice care. So I'm probably going to do a pretty good job. Mm-hmm. Not wanting karma to catch me the wrong way at that end of life. And, I mean, they even allowed families to come in and spend, in somebody's dying days, few days, they'd allow families to come in and stay in the prison with them. But
correct.
I know that's a little bit
more difficult. Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Barker, we have an active hospice program, so we do manage end-of-life care. We do not participate in assisted suicide in our prison system, but we do manage end-of-life care. I think we'd have to define some attributes of what an elderly patient is. You can see the range from anywhere from 50 to 75. I think we'd have to define that. Then we could go back and mine that data to see what percentage would fall into those categories, and then we might be able to get that answer for you.
Okay.
Unfortunately, I, the EHR with the background analysis program would help us with that versus doing the manual.
Yeah, I don't want to tie up, I mean, tons of time, and maybe I can get off some of the information the good senator gets.
Correct.
And we can try to figure something out.
Correct.
Thank you.
Welcome. It is important to us to understand that our adults in custody's needs, strategic plan on how we'll meet those needs, continue to provide managed care model, and our TPA case management strategic plan around infirmary bed location. And here's an example. Infirmary beds on the west side. As I mentioned earlier, we provide infirmary levels of care in five of our larger institutions. The majority of those beds are located east of the Cascades, 40 active beds for men on the east side, 23 active beds for men on the west side, which presents challenges in managing male inmates who need infirmary-level care on the west side of the state. There's greater access to specialty providers and hospital care in the Salem-Portland area. Unfortunately, we have the fewest infirmary beds. This means that we struggle to find room in the west side infirmary beds for patients who are recovering from surgery, discharged from the hospital, or have chronic illnesses. Conversely, we have more infirmary beds on the east side of the state in rural areas where medical resources are scarce. We are taxing the resources in general population with patients who need assistance with daily living. We have challenges in two different ways, yet similar situations. In terms of medical, we have a little more flexibility that we could potentially address our needs in a dorm setting. For mental health, however, the challenges of Alzheimer's and dementia decrease our flexibility. Electronic health records.
Yeah. So how many Alzheimer's and dementia residents do you have?
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Winters, I don't have that data. I think that would go back to our ability to extract that data manually versus having an electronic health record. But at this point, I don't have that information.
But that's a part of your challenge.
But I can certainly go back and figure out if that's possible and get that information.
But I kind of gather that's a part of your challenge, Matt, so I'm just trying to figure out what your universe is.
Yeah.
That's our challenge. Yes, ma'am. Electronic health records. Department of Correction is excited about the prospect of implementing a health records system, or an EHR. Inmate paper medical files are cumbersome, ineffective, and are difficult to query data for the strategic decision-making. Although there has been a delay in this initiative, it has been a productive delay, as moving through the DAS IT procurement stage gate process has taken our due diligence to a higher level to ensure our final product will meet our current needs for Department of Corrections, connect to community partners, and sustain and is sustainable for the future. We have developed our initial business case and have submitted it to DAS and have received approval to proceed to Stage Gate 2 when funding's available.
Mr. Chair, has that proposal been sent to our Julie, to Mr. Cummings? Do you know?
I don't know. I can find it.
Well, could you find that out? Because if not, he should review it, and then, you know, to make certain that it meets this body's standards over on this side. DAS is one piece, and we're the other piece. Also, to make certain that the partners include the CCOs as well as the, and the tricky part may be the interfacing with some of the hospitals. But anyway. I understand that not all their softwares are compatible.
Correct. Improving programs and cost savings. Of course, Medicaid for inpatient stays has had a huge impact. The addition of a dialysis center at on-site at Coffee Creek Correctional Facility has had a huge impact. The hiring of the medical recruiter has an impact. Managing pharmaceuticals, medical store costs through prepay and MCAP membership, huge impact on our budget. Understanding core staffing model structure, managing inmate through core, equipment management, position management, contract management, those have all had an impact, and they're projects that the health services team has initiated to be fiscally responsible. In conclusion, the Department of Corrections Health Service Division is proud of the care we provide in the challenging environment. We remain focused and committed to enhance staff engagement, improve the quality of care delivered, implement continuous improvement initiatives, role model fiscal accountability, and continue meeting the growing needs of our patients. Thank you for your time, and I'd be happy to answer any additional questions you may have.
Without the good doctor, we have fewer questions. Not the good doctor with fewer questions.
Well, she had an emergency, medical emergency. So, but anyway.
All right. Thank you, Joe.
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, as we transition, we're almost on schedule. I'll introduce Assistant Director Heidi Stewart, who is our Assistant Director for the Offender Management and Rehabilitation Division. Thank you. As the assistant director, along with a strong team of leaders, Ms. Stewart manages a continuum of evidence-based program interventions, as well as other opportunities and tools to adults in custody to enhance their transition to our community corrections partners. She has been with the department for 21 years in many roles, including superintendent and assistant superintendent, and she has spent many years in the transitional services arena. So you are in good hands. I will turn it over to Ms. Stewart.
Thank you, Director. Good afternoon, Co-Chair Stark, Co-Chair Winters, members of the committee. I am Heidi Stewart, the Assistant Director of the Offender Management and Rehabilitation Division with the Oregon Department of Corrections. And I think we're going to get the slides
Yes,
up here. So first off, the Offender Management and Rehabilitation Division, I'll refer to as OMR, is comprised of multiple functional units totaling 206 FTE. There we go. OMR is 4.6% of the agency's total fund budget and 4.5% of the agency's general fund budget. In this slide, we're looking at the OMR FTE in comparison to the rest of the agency. And while we make up just 4.4% of the agency's total FTE, we also have nearly 200 contractors on site providing education, treatment, and training. The OMR division is also responsible for coordinating more than 2,200 volunteers who provide invaluable services to our population. OMR's purpose is to provide the coordinated rehabilitation of adults in our care and custody. As a result, one of our primary budget drivers is providing effective treatment and programming. We deliver this programming primarily through contracted services. Costs for the services we provide continue to rise, like GED testing services and the evolving technological needs of our work-based education programs. Much like the rest of the department, staff salaries and benefits also are a major part of our budget drivers. Intake is a place of heightened emotion for approximately 5,200 adults coming into our custody each year. As the reality of incarceration settles, with the assistance of our staff, they must learn to navigate new social and structural norms. During their 30-day stay at intake, our staff individually assess each person to ensure safe and appropriate housing that leads to successful reentry. Assessments are done on medical and mental health status, education and programming eligibility, classification, risk, need, responsivity factors, and the person's unique vulnerabilities and strengths. Intake staff know that safely housing and accurately assessing nearly 500 people at any one time is much more of an art as it is a series of boxes to check. We must be innovative. For example, we change the way we house first-time adults in custody while they are at intake. We separate the first-time offenders from repeat offenders. This is why, in part, in comparison to 2014, we reduced overall numbers of inmate misconducts in our intake units by 30%, including a 25% drop on inmate assaults and a 25% decrease in staff assaults. We are updating our assessment process and moving from an outdated manual Scantron system to an automated electronic entry of data. We have developed a quality assurance model to ensure our assessment tools are administered accurately. And finally, one that I am most proud of is that we implemented the Women's Risk Need Assessment Tool. This is an evidence-based assessment tool specific to the unique needs and challenges faced by women in the criminal justice system. Research indicates that women have different risk factors than men. These risk factors are not typically captured in a gender-neutral assessment tool. Those are trauma and abuse, unhealthy relationships, parental stress, depression, and safety. Research consistently demonstrates more successful outcomes for women when a gender-responsive approach is used, and we'll talk more about gender-responsive treatment approaches in just a few minutes. As you can see, intake's work lays the foundation for the adults in our custody's case management throughout their incarceration. In order to ensure we are making informed decisions, we have proposed legislation that would extend sunset language, allowing DOC continued access to juvenile records. Without this information, individuals may be inaccurately assessed for things like housing placement, work assignment, program assignment, and so on. So what happens at intake in the first 30 days sets the course, and from there, the person's case plan is built upon using what we call the Correctional Case Management, or CCM. CCM began about 10 years ago, and further enhancement of CCM is one of our Destination 2026 strategic initiatives. CCM places our correctional counselors at the center of case planning, creating a collaborative effort towards success. To begin, we are doing a thorough life cycle analysis of case planning from intake through release planning, asking ourselves, are we maximizing limited resources by targeting our moderate and high-risk offenders? Are we tailor-making those services based on individual needs? Are we furthering a multidisciplinary approach that draws upon the insight of corrections professionals throughout the department? So here's an example of how CCM works. It's a very simplistic example. Mr. Smith is currently serving his third custody cycle. He has spent 15 of the last 20 years in one of our correctional facilities. Mr. Smith managed through numerous lifelong struggles, but when he found out his mother had terminal medical diagnosis, he became increasingly depressed and very angry. Uncharacteristic to previous incarcerations, Mr. Smith reached out to security staff. He was afraid he was going to hurt himself, so he reached out. Staff worked collaboratively to secure Mr. Smith housing that would help him get through this difficult time. They discussed his progress weekly at multidisciplinary meetings, so those meetings include counselors, mental health staff, medical staff, security staff, and so on. And they coordinated in-person visits from work supervisors, mental health supports, and other supportive stakeholders to ensure that he was safe and got him through that time. The CCM initiative will include development of a quality assurance process to ensure case management is applied consistently and accurately across the state. CCM is critical to our success and directly supports KPM number 2. KPM number 2 measures the percentage of releasing medium and high risk men and women who enter a program prioritized on their case plan and complete it. We are at 78%. The Offender Information and Sentence Computation Unit, OISC, is a very complex part of our organization. The sentencing laws that have passed over the years are complicated and intertwined. The staff must understand the multifaceted sentencing laws, interpret sentence judgments, and apply earned time reductions and calculate creditable county jail time to determine the projected release date. This unit continually mitigates risk through well-designed systems and processes. In recent years, OISC has successfully navigated through significant law changes that increased short-term transitional leave and changed how we calculate credit for time served from county jail. OISC staff are the go-to experts in Oregon on current and historical sentencing laws. As such, they do presentations and partner across the they do presentations to partners across the state, including jail and court staff, district attorneys, defense counsel, and judges. The Office of Population Management centrally manages the placement and movement of each person sentenced to the Department of Corrections, including those housed out of state, in OYA, and in other jurisdictions. Our staff work hard to ensure each person is placed in the right bed to meet each individual's multidimensional needs, including programming, medical and mental health, security concerns, gender identity, and protected class issues, including ADA. This process can be very rewarding, like when an individual thanks us for our many efforts to keep them safe. Other times, this process can be less rewarding. I don't think any of us forgets that our prison holds handfuls of very dangerous individuals. Our population management staff have received death threats and attempted assaults as a result of housing decisions that ensure the safety of our staff and the men and women in our care and custody. Determining proper institution placement is no easy task in an ideal circumstance, but becomes especially difficult when you consider the department is operating 880 emergency beds. As you are aware, capacity issues have become extremely challenging at the Coffee Creek Correctional Facility where we house our women. And as we explore options for dealing with the capacity issues at Coffee Creek, we prioritize work release and reentry programs over other options because they include programming and intensive reentry programming. They also target women at the end of their sentence. For these reasons, the department has engaged in conversations and partnered with counties to provide work release and reentry programs. At this time, we are actively working with four counties. These four counties have had their PREA audit, and a PREA auditor has determined the counties should be fully compliant within their 180-day corrective action phase. It's important to note the department can no longer enter into contracts with a facility that isn't PREA compliant, or the department will lose its PREA compliance designation. If we lose our designation, the state is subject to the loss of 5% of any U.S. DOJ grant funds. So now a little bit about the four programs. We've worked with Lane County for a few years now on work release and have a current contract that allows the department to send up to 6 women to the county program on work release status. In January, we began sending women to the Marion County Transition Center. This program can take up to 20 women and is both a work release program and a reentry program. This means for women that are work release eligible, they may leave the center for things like job interviews and other appointments in the community that assist them in their reentry to the community. Those not work release eligible must remain at the transition center at all times. We are engaging in ongoing conversations and working out details with both Jackson and Multnomah counties. Jackson will likely serve women who are work release eligible, releasing to Jackson, Klamath, and Josephine counties.
So on that note.
Yes.
When you said they're released into the, if they're eligible, they're released into the community for various appointments and so forth. Is there supervision during that time when they're released into the community, or they just go out on their own?
Co-Chair Stark, when someone is work release eligible, they do not have to be escorted by a security staff into the community. That's correct.
You're still going through the other programs? Or was that your overview of the four?
That was my overview on work release.
So. Okay, so these will be similar questions for short-term trans leave later. But, okay. You know, what are the minimum requirements as far as treatment that the counties have to do? So if someone's in work release, you know, if you can kind of walk me through what a person goes through, you know, regardless of their assessment, you know, what is their daily, what does their day look like? What sort of, you know, AA meetings, treatment meetings, cognitive behavioral therapy, what sort of things are they actually going through while they're there?
Okay. Chair or Co-Chair Stark, each county's program looks a little bit differently. However, my expectations at a minimum would be that they have intensive reentry planning. So, for example, those women going to Lane County, those are only work release eligible women. They're going there 60 days to release, so they actually leave the center every day. They go to sponsors. I don't know if you're familiar with sponsors in Lane County. They're a housing agency that provides intensive services such as alcohol and drug treatment, cognitive services, intensive reentry planning. So for those women, the intensive reentry planning is enough. But for example, for a Marion County program, the women go there 6 months prior to release. So Marion County takes women that have a high alcohol and drug treatment need, so they need to be able to provide an alcohol and drug treatment program because we can't get them necessarily into the program prior to the time that they're ready to go to the Marion County program. With Lane County, again, since they're 60 days prior to release, we can back that up. We can get them their alcohol and drug treatment and then send them to the county for intensive reentry planning. So each county, depending on their proposal to us, will offer different types of programs. Does that help answer that question?
Yes. So is there a minimum amount, you know, because that's significantly different between those two counties. Is there a minimum amount of treatment that a county would have to make sure that an individual is receiving, or those wraparound services that they would have to guarantee they're receiving in order to be even be considered by you guys?
Yes. So for a long-term program like Marion County, there's a certain number of alcohol and drug treatment hours that we would expect them to provide to our women because our women are high risk, high need. For our programs that are shorter term, they would have to provide all of the reentry services that the Department of Corrections provides. For example, ensuring that they have the appropriate documentation prior to release. So birth certificate, social security card. They would have to be able to set them up for Medicaid benefits, social security benefits, veterans benefits if they're eligible. So all of those services, those reentry services that we would provide, I would expect the county to provide.
And what work are they doing? Because it's work release. So there's an assumption that they're being released to go work.
Co-Chair Stark, it is incorrectly named.
Okay.
It's what the law refers to it as. There are actually two types of work release. This is one type of work release where they can go out into the community for reentry planning. There's another type of work release that the Department of Corrections does not do, and that is where they can release from our institution into the community to work a job, and then they'll come back in the evening to, you know, eat their meal or stay the night. And we while that's allowed in statute, we haven't engaged in that since the 1990s.
Okay. I'm sure I'll have more questions soon.
Okay.
And I would just add, great description, Mr. Co-Chair, I would just add that expectation that Ms. Stewart has with those county programs is actually then included in the county DOC contract.
Mr. Chair.
Chair Winters.
Even though the work aspect isn't a part of some of the contracts, it is the expectation of the of some counties that when they talk about services, a part of that services, I know for Marion County, is to try to also make certain that you're getting the individuals employed or getting them into whether it's Chemeketa, but you actually have a plan so that they're able to actually become a sustained and functional within the community. This is not just talking about you're releasing individuals into the community and there is not a plan for their continuation. So actually employment is a part of it. It's just how the contract with DOC is actually put together. But I know for our county, it is an expectation that you will be having those are services that are also will be provided to the residents as they come through.
So to make sure I'm understanding this, so it's not work releases in the sense of what we've seen historically and referred to as work release. This is really early reentry planning and assistance.
Co-Chair Stark, I think that's a good way to describe it. That's right. That's why we are taking women just prior to their release date, putting them into the county where they are going to be released so that all of those county wraparound services can take effect and they are better prepared for reentry out into their home community.
Okay. And so when you say just prior, that's typically 60 days?
In Lane County, it's 60 days. In Marion County, it's 6 months.
Okay. And so what do Multnomah and Jackson, what's the plan there on
there? We're still negotiating that. Jackson is talking longer term. I think they're looking at so that they can get enough numbers. They're looking at up to 6 months. And Multnomah County, we're still having detailed conversations on pulling data and numbers to see what that would look like.
And so do they have to go back to the county of origin? Because I've been hearing about Jackson County potentially taking Josephine and Klamath County individuals as well.
Co-Chair Stark, that's correct. Jackson County approached me and said they would like to also include their neighboring counties, Klamath and Josephine counties, to be able to have a number of women in that program to make it cost benefit for them, essentially. Otherwise, if they don't include their neighboring counties, it's going to be maybe a handful of women, probably close to the Lane County size, six women or less. But I know they haven't made that decision final yet. They're still working internally and with their neighboring counties on what that's going to look like.
I know I'm asking a lot of questions and throwing off your timing here.
That's okay. So, I can talk fast.
And as far as things that would cause them to be sanctioned during that last 60 days, what are some of the things? Like, you know, or dirty UAs? Or, I mean, what are some of the things that would cause them to be either put back into the county jail or sent back to you guys?
So they would be sent back to us if they had dirty UAs. The county works really hard to try to manage these individuals within their centers. But if somebody, you know, assaulted a staff person or got into a fight, they would be coming back to us. That's our commitment to them, is at any point you think this individual needs to come back to us, no questions asked, we're going to take them back. I will say we haven't had any major issues thus far in our county programs. And the reason for that is, and I think the best way, and I'm taking up a lot more time than I probably should, but I think it'll be helpful. The best way to describe this is after Marion County became operational in January, a couple weeks after that, I went down to talk to the women in the program. And when I was talking to them, they said, I got to tell you, I was so angry. They used other words. I was so angry that you put me on that bus to send me to a work release facility. You've taken me away from my community of women. I don't have the yard that I used to have. I don't have the canteen items that I used to have. I don't get the prize point. And they've had this whole list of stuff that they don't get. And so this one lady said, I'm telling you, I got off that bus and I looked for the first person that I could punch in the face the next day so that I would be sent back to Coffee Creek so I could get all the things that I'm used to. Well, the next day, Marion County started engaging these women in programming. And they quickly learned that this program was all about them. And this program was about setting them up for success upon release. And she told me, thank goodness for the programs that they have here, because that's why I am fully engaged, and now I understand why you brought me to Marion County's Work Release Center.
And so since we've done the newfound work release, again, distinguishing from the old school work release, roughly how many individuals have gone through that program?
How many women? Oh, Co-Chair Stark, I'm going to have to go back and ask my team for those numbers. It's not a bunch of women that have gone through it since we just started the Marion County program in January, and it's a six-month program. Lane County has had just a few women go through their program because their criteria is much more strict since they are only a work release program. But I'll get those numbers for you.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, just to add some more context to this, and I know Marion County did, and I'm assuming that the other counties would too. Marion County went through a real risk assessment of the women prior to them being identified as the 20 women that would be returned back to Marion County. So this is not just say, you go, you go, you go, you go. There was a lot of advanced work that is done. before the individuals are actually coming back. Marion County, of course, has a center, and you know, the pre-planning to make certain that we had the resources there in order to provide those wraparound services and to do the kind of work that is required. Marion County was ready to actually take up to the 20 individuals, you know, and so I think the community is prepared for it. Marion County also has a robust public-private partnership with employers in this town, and have been over the years of working with this community in order to hire and to bring in individuals from out of, coming back from the institution. So, you know, you've got a lot of things that are going on in the community.
Thank you.
Rep. Sanchez.
Thank you. You may have said this while I was out of the room, but I'm curious as to somewhat a part of Coach Stark's question about the volume, essentially. What's the capacity of these programs? And knowing that we have probably far more women coming out on a consistent basis than these programs have capacity for, what does that percentage look like of people actually going to be able to access this program versus those who will exit the prison system without those resources?
Co-Chair Stark, Representative Sanchez, the programs, Marion County can hold up to 20 women, Lane County can take up to 6 women, and Multnomah and Jackson County are still working on their proposals, so we don't know the exact numbers as of yet. Senator Winters mentioned that Marion County, we meet monthly. A multidisciplinary team meets monthly, reviews the list of eligible women. On that list, during our first meeting, we had 75 women over, I believe, in the 70s, women who were releasing to Marion County over a certain period of time. So I think it was 6 to 9 months. And after going through that list and determining who was eligible, so custody level, who didn't have a high mental health need, high medical need, who wasn't a high disciplinary problem, we found 14 women who could go to that program at that point in time. Now, that number is going to climb over time, but we don't have a waiting list. We really are meeting the needs of the women who are eligible for a program like that. In Lane County, we have up to 6 beds. Today, we don't have any women there. Lane County has done their preliminary screening, and the next female that we have in line to go down there, I believe, won't be until May. So we really make sure that these women are appropriate for these programs.
So, and I know you touched on this a minute ago, but as far as housing them, there's you referenced some at a center, some with transitional housing. Remind me one more time. So at the end of the day, are they sleeping where there's actually supervision, or are they sleeping in the community where there is not supervision?
Co-Chair Stark, some counties call their facilities transition centers. Some counties call their facilities work release centers. There is supervision on site 24 hours a day. It's not like they're going to an Oxford House, it's supervised.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Another way of looking at it, it's structured.
Mm-hmm.
It is not where individuals are coming out and then they come in and say, I'm here, I'm signing up and okay, and now I'm out in the community. That is not the way this is. I just need to put that there because, you know, we have individuals who listen to our testimony, but that's not the way. It's very structured. And centers, the centers do have on-site supervision. They're not at free will, if that helps you.
Right. It does help.
One more.
Rep. Sanchez.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Similar to what Jackson and Josephine and Klamath County might be doing in terms of trying to create a volume of folks for that particular program, is that going to be an option for, say, Lane or Multnomah or anybody else if they say, well, you know, there just isn't the volume of women coming? Multnomah may be different once they get it together, but right now, if you only have one person in the Lane program, is it an option to bring somebody in to do that?
Southern Oregon Special.
Yes, I know Southern Oregon is special, but given the small volume of folks eligible for this program, of the 75 plus or whatever it is that you have eligible for release.
Yeah. Co-Chair Stark, Representative Sanchez, while Southern Oregon is special, we leave that up to the counties. It depends on their partnerships with their neighboring counties and how they want to approach it. So it certainly isn't something that we say they can't do. It's something we would allow if that is a program they wanted to run.
Okay. So my computer died, so I can't look ahead. I don't know how many slides you want to try to cover in the next 4 minutes.
Stark, I have a lot of slides left to go, but I think I can get through one more slide in the next 3 or 4 minutes, okay, if that works for you.
Let's
just get as far as we can go. Okay, so we're moving on to education, training, and treatment. One of the things we often say around the Department of Corrections is the majority of the people in our custody will release one day, and they will become our neighbors, they will parent our children's school friends, and in this case, they will change our oil. One of our staff was having her car serviced in Salem. She struck up a conversation with a technician and mentioned her education work in prisons. The technician grew excited, going on to tell her about how completing his GED at the Two Rivers Correctional Institution helped turn his life around. He found employment upon release and felt successful. During the conversation, his supervisor made a point to comment on the great job his employee does. Education does transform lives. Of particular interest to us in the Department of Corrections, it also reduces recidivism. A 2013 meta-analysis report published by the RAND Corporation found that on average, inmates who participate in correctional education programs have a 43% lower odds of recidivating than those inmates who do not participate in education. Through interagency agreements and strong collaboration with various community colleges, we provide our Adult Basic Skills Development Program, which includes adult basic education, English as a second language, GED, and special education. While we do not spend general fund dollars to get individuals advanced degrees, our community college partners do provide college classes through private grants, donations, and self-pay by adults in our custody. In June of last year, we celebrated that Chemeketa Community College was selected as one of 67 colleges and universities in the country awarded the Second Chance Pell Grant Program. This award makes our incarcerated adults served by Chemeketa eligible for Pell Grants to pursue Chemeketa's degree programs. The RAND meta-analysis I mentioned just a few minutes ago also showed that the odds of obtaining employment post-release was 13% higher for adults in custody who participated in correctional education and 28% higher for those individuals who participated in vocational training. With this in mind, we offer a number of vocational programs that help inmates develop specific skills that will assist them in obtaining employment following release. All of these programs include training and a production component that provide a product or service that generate revenue to reduce the costs of the programs. The Education, Training, and Treatment Unit also oversees the apprenticeship programs, which involve a partnership between the Department, the Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industries, and the Columbia Gorge Joint Apprenticeship Training Committee. Show. Would you like
me
to fill in the last minute?
If that's a good stopping point. Okay. All right. Final comments for the good of the order?
I just would say I am concerned about the phone bid, and I know it's not your fault, DAS, but that doesn't make any sense to me at all. It's going to take 3 years. The phone.
The telephone.
Oh, the contract.
Yeah, I mean, that doesn't seem reasonable, and maybe we need to follow back up with DAS.
Yeah.
Mr. Co-Chair and Representative Barker, I did receive an update from my team while we were sitting up here. DAS is starting the procurement now and visited OSP last week to get started, so we hope it's much sooner than 3 years. They simply extended it for 3 years as a safety net.
But so if I have that contract and I'm going to, and you come up and say somebody's, we have a new bid, I'm going to say, well, wait a minute, I have 3 years. Can you cancel the contract?
Okay. Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Barker, that is in the contract that we can terminate early.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. On that note, we are adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
I'll let you go.
Thank you, everyone.
I'll let you go.